News now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And it was another fun week in technology. Apple was awarded $1 billion in damages in the Samsung patent battle. I'm not actually too happy about that, but we will discuss what it means for the future of technology and what the issues were. And this weekend, very special weekend, it's the Space Elevator Conference weekend.
Oh, my. I wondered when that would
That's right. So this is the Space Elevator. They have an annual conference on the Space Elevator. We will talk about...
Where's
so
David Berg?
Instead of having
him?
A rocket ship, you just take an elevator to space. We'll talk about that, what the technology challenges are there. Facebook had a few problems this week. People were getting all sorts of users added to their account. They thought people had been hacked, but actually... it was user error. Mars rover is taking its first move on Mars. It's actually getting some good vibes. We have also social media is being used very heavily by the politicians, and in particular at the political convention. So we'll highlight what's being done at the political conventions since the Republican convention starts this week. And NIST has published some new guidelines for BIOS protection. I'll tell you why that's important. I mean, not everybody really cares about their BIOS, but...
No, but you'll tell us why we need to.
I'm going to tell you why you need to. And we're going to feature the woman who was a co-founder, president, and CEO of VMware. She's no longer president because she was fired in 2008, but she took it from almost nothing up to where it was. And of course, it was a huge mailbag as always.
But hey, to interrupt, but you have show and tell later on too.
Oh yes,
and this is important for our viewers on Home and Garden Network.
Yes, we are going to show a device. It's the device of the week for aerating wine that uses the Venturi effect. And we've got a very fine bottle of Cabernet here in the studio, ready. It's the finest Cabernet, ready to pour it, and we're going to run a taste test to see which is better.
The finest you can find in a box.
That's right. But, you know, the mailbag was huge.
It was.
So now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. We have an email from Alex. Dear Tech Talk, can I safely use my cell phone for online banking while I am traveling? What app do I need? Thanks, Alex. Well, Alex, that's a great question because normally I tell people don't do online banking if they're going to be on open Wi-Fi at an airport or if they're going to use a public kiosk. But it turns out that a cell phone is actually a pretty good option for you. It's fairly secure, and I think there are some very excellent applications for doing exactly what you want to do. Either your bank or your credit card will actually have an application. You can log on. It has password protection, and those are pretty effective. I'll tell you, I use Bank of America online client for my cell phone. I don't have a checkbook anymore. Somebody needs I can open up my cell phone and I can write a check out for somebody and they'll get it in 2 or 3 days. It'll be mailed to them.
Really?
It's very convenient. I've also got the Bank of America application on my iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have to log on. You have to provide. There's authentication and all of that. But the nice thing is, since it's going out over the cell phone network, it's more secure than open Wi-Fi. Now, if you don't have an application, you can use the browser in your cell phone. But if you're using open unsecured Wi-Fi, make certain to use secure socket layer, which, of course, that's HTTPS. Would be the prefix to that address, and the S on the HTTP stands for secure, and that's an encrypted data stream, which means your password is encrypted. If you do not use HTTPS and you're on an unencrypted Wi-Fi, somebody can just sit there and they can just grab your passwords as you use them. Also, if you're on a, just sort of as a note, if you don't log into any banking or any critical accounts on kiosks because frequently there are password loggers there. They just log in on the and they just collect passwords.
Sure.
They save passwords. They cache them. People can come after the fact and log on. So I would, and you never really know what's on those computers, so I don't trust them for anything secure. But great question, Alex.
Yeah, really. I would have said, you know, at first blush, no way.
Yeah, it's very convenient. I love it.
Are different bank websites and apps more secure than others?
I have not compared them.
Just the one that you use?
I just use Bank of America. Mm-hmm. I love that app. That's actually a good question. Maybe I'll look around and see what other what other apps the other banks have.
I love giving you work.
Yeah, okay. That'll be my research project, you know, after I get a glass of aerated wine here in a minute.
That ought to work out good.
We got an email from John. Dear Doc and Jim, I'm not sure I understand how to tether the laptop to my iPhone. Could you explain this to me, please? Do I use a USB cord that came with my phone, or, you know, what's the process? Thanks, John. Well, John, there are several ways to tether your phone to your laptop. Unfortunately, most, if not all, require a data plan. You just can't hook your cell phone up and use your cell phone internet access for your laptop. The carriers have blocked that.
Aha.
They don't want you to use that data. They want you to get another data plan and pay for another device. So they've really kind of cut into your options. Now, you may actually be able to bypass that if you have, say, an internet service that provides a dial-in phone number when you're traveling. Like Cox or sometimes, I don't know if Verizon does, some of the internet service providers that provide internet access to your home will provide a dial-up phone number for you when you're traveling. So actually, if you do have that, you could set up and use your phone as a modem, and you have to install the software to support it, but then you simply dial using the cell phone as a modem, you dial the number and go into that ISP number that you were given, and you could get internet access there, but you'll probably get a fairly low bandwidth, probably 4 kilobits per second. But I've done that actually, and it's good enough for email, but not good enough for surfing the web. Now you can also connect your cell phone either through Bluetooth or by plugging the USB cable into your computer, or you could set up in some cases your phone as a Wi-Fi hotspot. I know that Android phones support this. The iPhone supports it, and then you can simply connect to your phone and make it a Wi-Fi hotspot, and you can surf the web through the phone that way. Here's the rub. The carriers also block that unless you pay them. Verizon charges $20 a month to convert your phone to a Wi-Fi hotspot, which is kind of expensive, and then you've got another data limit of 2 gigabytes. For that period. And if you go beyond 2 gigabytes, they charge you an arm and a leg for overages. So, and you can't lump the data pools with your regular data pool with the hotspot data pool. So it's kind of expensive, and I don't really like it because why don't they just let you use your bandwidth any way you want?
Right.
We got an email from, but it was a great question.
Yes.
We got an email from Leslie in Fairfax. My CD tray keeps going in and out erratically. That could be disconcerting. Some people just put a drink on it. They use it as they use it as a cup holder.
If it's going in and out erratically, yeah, that could get very messy.
It could, you know. I mean, so you know, some people just put it out and they use it as a cup holder.
Are you saying that CDs aren't that big a deal anymore? Is that what you're
but
saying?
I'm really saying it's not advisable. But I did know somebody that actually didn't know much about computers. They said, wow, look at this. You've got a built-in You've got a built-in cup holder in your computer.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, I'm not going to say who that
it
was.
It wasn't me.
I'm not saying.
It wasn't me.
No, it wasn't you. No, it was not you. No, that is very true. Well, let me see. Let me get back to the.
What was the question?
Yeah. Okay. And what do I do? Thanks, Leslie. Okay,
Don't use it as a cup holder.
I got sidetracked. Well, I think it's probably a faulty CD player. Now these are actually quite cheap. They're less than $100. Now I would upgrade it from a CD player to either a DVD or a DVD CD read write, so you could actually write CDs or
idea.
DVDs. I mean, and you know, you pay another $15 and you can get a big upgrade.
Hmm.
Now, if you want to be certain that it's actually the faulty CD, you could borrow a CD from a friend's computer, plug it in to see whether that makes a difference. But I'm pretty certain that it is that particular issue. Now, if you have a desktop, you didn't say what you had. If you have a desktop machine, you're going to have to open the case. You're going to have to unplug the cords that connect to the CD player. There's going to be a power cord, and there's going to be a data cord. And then you take out a couple of screws and slide it out of the case. And then simply, and you can. The nice thing about these plugs, you can only plug them in one way.
Right.
And you can't put them in backwards. You can't put the wrong plug in the wrong place.
They're
so it's
proof.
Fine. They are. They really are. There's no problem there. I just advise you, turn off the power and unplug it before you do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a laptop, you can simply pop the CD out of the laptop because it plugs into the laptop. There are no wires.
So no kidding.
So it's very easy to change a CD in a laptop. You just... Normally, there's a set screw, and you can just, you got to find the set screw. Now, you don't want to unscrew the wrong screw and have the insides fall out.
That'd be bad.
So you want to make certain that you're unscrewing the screw that's actually holding in the CD.
Which will probably be the screw closest to the CD,
I
would suspect.
It is, but it's not always clear. Sometimes it's not exactly clear which one you should do. So you might want to check your manual of your laptop before you start unscrewing things. I did have one, my niece one time was trying to fix her laptop, and she just unscrewed all the screws, and it was a nightmare. I actually think she she was actually trying to, quote unquote, fix her boyfriend's laptop.
She fixed it all right.
I think in the end, he bought a new laptop.
That would be fixing it.
And he's no longer her boyfriend. That's another story.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's another story. Okay, uh-huh. We got an email from Loyal Listener. Oh, uh-huh. Loyal Listener writes to us a lot. Dear Tech Talk, I have an HP OfficeJet 6500 wireless. I use Wi-Fi, and suddenly it'll not connect to my laptop. I can't print anything. Now, I've gone to the HP website. I've downloaded everything. I'm trying to get up, but I still can't get it to print. My printer is 4 or 5 years old. Do you have any advice for me? Thanks, Loyal Listener. Well, Loyal Listener, I try several things. I have this problem in my house. There's somebody in my house that also has trouble printing stuff, and they always come to me for help.
Marianne.
Yes, M-A as it would be. First of all, I say what you do is you reboot everything. Reboot your computer, reboot the Wi-Fi router, and reboot the printer. That means rebooting, just turn it off, turn it back on again, and that will reset everything. Now, that frequently will fix the problem. The second thing I would suggest is clear the print queue.
Yeah.
Because you can right click on the printer icon and you'll bring up the printer box. You can then delete all the jobs in the print queue. Frequently when I have to deal with a printer problem at home, there will be 30 documents in the print queue.
And it's all the same one, right?
It's all the same one, and a document from maybe 2 weeks ago is jammed and not printing. And so all the new ones just can't print because you got that jammed document in the beginning. So you have to go through and delete all the documents. Sometimes the one document which is jammed won't delete until you reboot. So you might clear the queue, and if you can't clear them all out of the queue, you might reboot your computer again just to clear the print queue. Now, that is normally the winner. When I clear the print queue, normally everything works. But sometimes I have to do more if it still doesn't work. The next thing that you do is that you uninstall the print driver. Sometimes the print driver gets corrupted. I uninstall the print driver, and then I reinstall the print driver. And then I reboot it. So that's my whole process. And I'm telling you, that works 100% of the time. If it still doesn't work, then I would check perhaps your printer is not functioning correctly. You might try to plug your computer directly into your printer using a printer cable to see whether the printer is actually working. That would be the next thing. But if you try these three steps, because this works in my household about once a month, it's very good. I really should make a user manual on this thing, and just leave it. I need a domestic help desk.
Would it be red if you made it?
No, it wouldn't be red.
Okay.
That is another.
I'm not gonna.
Now, we have an email from a friend in Bethesda. Dear Doc, I have a question about passwords for online accounts. If I type my password wrong 3 times in a row, I get locked out of my email account until it's reset. So how can hackers try a whole set of passwords from a dictionary to hack into my account without getting blocked?
Great question.
And I get notified of an intrusion. I never really understood that.
Great question.
Well, if there are many passwords, if three passwords typically tried in rapid succession, you will get your account locked. But if you put in passwords, say, not in quick succession, maybe separated by 90 seconds, you won't.
Oh.
Because it won't do it. I mean, there's a certain time out there. So hackers don't only hack your account. They hack 10,000 accounts. So they rotate through all the accounts. So by the time they come back to your account with the next guest password, it's been so long that when they put it in, it won't lock out on them.
Chances are they might hit the jackpot with somebody else's account before they get to you, right?
They could. So they just go in and they just do these dictionary attacks, and they just run through account after account. And so that's one way to do that. Now, another way they could get your password is through a keylogger on a public machine. That's a program that captures keystrokes and sends them out over the internet to someone. Or it could be malware. That could be on your machine, and it could be detecting passwords. A certain malware that's installed on your machine, and it specifically looks for bank account passwords, and it sends them to some central location, and that has been a successful way to get bank account information. But most passwords that hackers get are found by hacking the database of the service provider. That's what they mostly do. And so your server, and you hear typically, some company has 10,000 passwords or 100,000 passwords that were revealed. And they'll typically go in and they'll hack the server, maybe using an SQL injection, which is very typical. Once they get access to the password database, they download it to their machine, and it's a hashed database. In other words, it's been encrypted. So they actually have to guess passwords and go through a dictionary technique to try to guess it and try to guess what the password is, that produced that particular hash or that particular encrypted character stream. And if the hash has not been seeded, which means it's with a slight offset between passwords, it's fairly easy to get at all the passwords in that hash, and they can simply just do a brute force attack on it. And if it hasn't been salted, as they say, it is fairly easy to get. And that's how most of the passwords are gotten. However, there's one more way that they can get passwords, and this requires on your compliance. They'll send out a letter saying, excuse me, we're having a problem with your account, and we're going to cancel your account unless you log into the website and verify your username and password immediately. And then they give you a link. You log in to the site, and of course it's a fake site, and you put in your username and password, bingo, they've got it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called phishing, because they are, and phishing. So those are all the ways they can get your passwords. And I think the last one is the one you've got to watch out the most. And these database hacks that they get, and they can get the passwords from the hash, that's probably the second most used technique. And then what you want to do to protect yourself is don't use the same password on all accounts. So if one gets hacked, you can just change it, but everything isn't done. Everything isn't revealed when you have one password, determined. We got an email from Jim in Loudoun County. Dear Doc and Jim, I'm paying about $55 a month for Fios Internet, and I'm supposed to be getting 25 megabits per second both upload and download. On the desktop computer, which is hardwired to the router, I'm getting that speed. I'm getting about 23 download and about 14 upload, which is, I'm happy with. The problem is that on my other desktop and my laptop, both of which are connected wirelessly, I'm only getting around 2.5 to 3 megabits per second. Can you help? Thanks, Jim. Well, let's look at this thing. Now, your wireless access point's obviously throttling your speed somehow, because when you go directly through the wired connection, you're getting the speed you want. So I assume that you've got a fast enough wireless to get it to get it 25 megabits per second. But 802.11n, which goes at 54 megabits per second, should be fast enough. Now, you never get 54 megabits per second because you've got overhead. you know, packet headers and overhead and collision overhead. So you might effectively get out of, instead of 54, you might get 40 megabits per second, but that's still above your 25 megabits per second. So you should, in theory, be able to get the upload and download speed that you want. Now, if your wireless is not 802.n, and you might have one of the old wireless technologies, and you're only at 10 megabits per second, in which case, when you put on the overhead, you're going to be down to about 6 or 7 megabits per second, and that may be your situation. Or you may have a router that is 54 megabits per second, but you've got a very old machine. And if you've got an old machine which is running at 10 megabits per second, all connections are slowed down to the slowest speed. So even if your laptop is, say, a high-speed connection, but your desktop is a low-speed connection because you've got an old NIC card, everything on the wireless is actually a slow connection, and you're down to 10 megabit per second. So you want to check that all your wireless connections on each of your devices are running at 54 megabits per second. Finally, you want to look to see if there are any other wireless access points in the neighborhood. You see, if your neighbor is running wireless, they're all in the same bandwidth, and they've got channels, they've got 11 channels, frequency channels you can have here in your wireless. There are only three non-overlapping channels, channel 1, channel 5 or 6, and channel 11. Those are non-overlapping because the channels are fairly broad bandwidth. So if your neighbor is also on channel 1 or also on channel 6 or also on channel 11 and they're close to you, you are sharing the same bandwidth. So that actually cuts your effective bandwidth in half. So what I do is I always, you know, because I like to see what my neighbors are up to, I check my neighbor's wireless, and if they're on 1, I'm on 11.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're on 11, I'm on 1. So I just make certain that I'm not on the same channel as my neighbors. So those are all the things that you could... Oh, and the final thing that you could do is check the distance between your device and the access point. Because as you get further and further away, the signal to noise goes down. Mm-hmm. And this wireless protocol automatically reduces the transmission speed as the signal to noise ratio goes down. So I would take the laptop to see whether that's the issue. Take the laptop and carry it and put it right beside the access point and then check the speed. And then go back to where you are and then check it back there. And so if it's turned out a distance issue, you may want to get a high-gain antenna, which we've talked about. You could get a 6 dB antenna. You could go down and sort of get an antenna and try to build up the signal to noise in the rest of the house. And you could want to kind of walk around to see where the speed are. So I've given you a lot of options to try to troubleshoot this. You didn't really give me enough information to give you the definitive answer, mm-hmm. but I think you've got enough information here to try to solve that problem. Great question, Jim.
Indeed. And time for us to take a little break here. The mailbag is empty for one more week. Doc, you're over there not just doing a radio broadcast. But
oh, no.
Wait a minute. It's not a radio show.
No, this is a classroom of the airways. And I'm actually monitoring the blackboard for the Classroom of the Airways, mm-hmm. which is our Facebook page, facebook.com/TechTalkOnline. Go there. If you got any comments, just post them to Tech Talk, and we'll talk about them on the show.
And, of course, this is Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2, brought to you by Stratford University. Learn more about our sponsors by going to stratford.edu. This is Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. Now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Diane Green. Diane Green co-founded VMware with her husband, Mendel Rosenblum, where she served as president and CEO for nearly 10 years. Diane Green was born in Rochester, New York, around 1955. She received a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering in 1976 from the University of Vermont. She loves to sail.
Really?
Yes, she loves to sail. She loves the water. So then in 1978, Diane Green went to MIT and received a Master of Science in Naval Architecture.
Huh.
So that was her passion, sailing, and so she thought she would work on designing ships or sailboats for the water. She went to San Francisco and worked for a consulting firm, and they designed large jacket structures, which are these massive four-legged devices that are better known as offshore drilling platforms. So she was very anxious. She did design work on it, and then she wanted to actually go to sea to examine her work. And then she discovered women are not allowed on oil rigs.
Really?
Did you know that?
No, I did not. Not till this very second.
No women are allowed on oil rigs.
I think I know why.
Yeah. I think
because there's no women on oil rigs.
Because there's no women on
oil rigs.
That's exactly right. So Green quit. She was so fed up. There's no hairdresser on the oil rig, Jim. That's the reason why.
Okay. Send your cards and letters to Dr. Richard Schertz.
So Green quit. And she moved in disgust to Hawaii to take up windsurfing.
I could move in disgust to Hawaii. I don't know about you.
So she took up windsurfing, you know, and I think she likes to.
It cleared her mind, I'm sure.
It did. I tried windsurfing off the, you know, off the coast of Spain. I'm a terrible windsurfer. You know, that sail, I got a cramp in my leg. It was blowing me out to the middle of the Mediterranean. Let me get back on track.
Diane Green.
Oh, yeah, Diane Green. No, thank you very much. Yeah, okay. Oh,
but
yeah.
But you digress.
After her windsurfing stint, she worked in the engineering department for Windsurfing International. And then she worked for Coleman. This is the Coleman camping gear company.
Yeah.
Because they were considering moving into the windsurfing business. Now, in 1988, she went to the University of California at Berkeley. UC Berkeley, they call it in short. She picked up a second master's degree in computer science. And there she met her future husband, who was an associate professor, Mendel Rosenblum. Now, she and Mendel were dating, and they got along quite well. He encouraged her. He was actually working on operating systems, on creating virtual operating systems. He had sort of, that was his kind of his passion, but he was like a, you know, typical college professor working on his research. And so he was just enjoying himself. But then after she got her master's degree, she wanted to have one last adventure before she would go back to work. So she served as a computer expert on a treasure hunt for a sunken Spanish galleon off of Saipan.
Are women allowed on pirate ships like that?
Apparently they are.
Okay, good.
Apparently they are. Well, computer experts are. I think it's all...
Maybe she was in drag.
So she came back after her treasure hunting expedition as the computer expert, and she worked for Tandem, which was a computer manufacturer, and then she worked for Silicon Graphics. During that time period after 1988, she got married, had two children, and was working at Tandem and Silicon Graphics. And then she was working on her second startup company in 1997. That was kind of a gap there, and work on our second startup company. It was a software company which was later bought by CMGI. And then she was ready to move on to the next venture. And her husband was working on this virtual operating system. And Green said, look, why don't I help you take this researchy idea and package it, and let's try to turn it into a company. I mean, that was, you know, for, you know, for, you know, this, you know, her husband was really not entrepreneurial per se, but that's like, okay, that's interesting. So in 1998, they formed VMware. So Green teamed with her husband, Mendel Rosenblum, who was professor of computer science. At that time, he then became a professor of computer science at Stanford. They teamed up with two of his graduate students that have been working on virtualization and an old graduate school friend from UC Berkeley. Now, they started out pretty small. Green quit her previous startup and signed up in 1998 as an unpaid employee. The following year, her husband, Rosenblum, took 2 years' leave from Stanford to work full-time at VMware. Now Diane Green agreed to help Rosenblum to basically productize the concept, and then she would move on. She wasn't planning to make this a whole career thing. And so she felt that he needed some help to actually, you know, commercialize the whole thing. Now, her plan was to set up the company, negotiate a few deals, and leave. But she stayed. Now, initially, they worked out of their home, and then they graduated to a small office, which they rented above the cheese house in a small shopping center across the street from Stanford.
I would spend a lot of time in the cheese house.
In the cheese house. And then they moved to another small house nearby when they needed a little bit more space, but everything was quite small. VMware was operated through 1998 in the stealth mode. Now, that means they didn't want anybody to know about it because they didn't want anybody to steal the ideas, and so they weren't really trying to raise money. They had roughly 20 employees by the end of the year. Maybe they had just some VC funding. I don't know about the initial funding. The company was launched officially February 1999. The beta version of VMware was downloaded by more than 75,000 people the first day. Mm. Now let me explain. Let me have a sidebar. Okay, what is this approved sidebar? What is this VMware anyway? What's a virtual machine? Well, it turned out that in the beginning, like an Intel machine was designed to operate only one operating system. You'd install Windows and that'd be it. That would be it. Well, VMware provided a software layer that made every operating system think that it was the only operating system operating on that machine. And so you could have multiple operating systems running at once, and VMware would moderate their calls to the hardware, so the hardware also thought it was only dealing with one operating system. So it was like this playing this sleight of hand. You could have multiple virtual machines on the same system. Now, the reason this was so important was that, you see, data centers, every server had a different machine in the old days. And you had to design this for peak usage. So during most of the time, the servers might only be at 15% utilization. So you got all these machines using all this power, and the utilization is extremely low. If you can put multiple servers on the multiple operating systems on the same machine and multiple processes on the same machine, you can push up the utilization of the hardware up to 80%. And so you're able to make your data centers much more efficient and use much less power. So this was a huge breakthrough. It turned out that Intel had been working on virtual machines in the 60s. And then they gave up on it, and it wasn't until VMware that people actually commoditized it and made it practical. I mean, actually, we run VMware in our server room at Stratford. We're running about 60 or 70 virtual servers. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't have 60 or 70 machines. You can create a new virtual server in 10 minutes, and then you can load something on. You don't have to go out and buy more hardware. You just have to make certain you have the resources for it. Now, VMware delivered its – now I'm back off the sidebar.
You're off the sidebar.
VMware delivered its first product, VMware Workstation, May of 1999, entered the server market in 2001 with VMware GSX Server. Now, the company was acquired in 2004 by EMC Corporation. That was a computer storage corporation, for $625 million. That's not bad. They started in 1998, and they sold it in 2004 for $625 million. Not bad.
No.
Now, Green, insisted when it was bought, Green stayed on, along with her husband, that when VMware was purchased by EMC, that they would have a distant relationship. Because, you see, EMC was competing with Microsoft. They were competing with a lot of VMware's clients. And if VMware became a competitive advantage for EMC, then they would lose their clients. So EMC treated VMware just as a standalone company. They had no, they weren't on the same database. They didn't share employees. They kept an arm's length distance, and that allowed VMware to continue to grow. Now, in August of 2007, this was 3 years after EMC bought VMware, they issued an IPO. And they basically released 10% of the stock in the IPO, and 10% of the stock for the IPO raised more than $1 billion. The IPO went from $29 on the initial price up to $51 the first day, producing a market capitalization of $20 billion. Mm. So this is what Green's thinking. 3 years ago, we sold the company for $625 million. EMC has been owning us for only 3 years, and I've built it, and they now have a valuation of $20 billion. Green said, you know, EMC got most of the upside, you see. So they weren't very happy.
No.
Now, you would think that Green would get, like, a big piece of this IPO. They only gave her 2.1% of it.
Huh.
So they were just a little pissed off. Well,
just,
that's a,
oh, that's, where's the dump button? Well, you can say that, I
oh,
think.
I can say that. Okay,
you just did.
That's a technical word.
Ah,
that's a technical word that you know, I don't know quite what it means.
No, we don't know what that means.
And yeah. So she did receive 2.1%, which is probably a few hundred million.
Mm-hmm. But still,
when there's $32 billion out there, you're saying, you know, hey, why don't I get more of it? Yeah, actually, her husband's idea.
Yeah.
But see, her husband, the reason this was the perfect combination, she was a very good manager. She would hire well. She would manage by objective. She had great management skills that allowed her to build the company up to a point of 5,000 employees and around $1.2 billion in revenue. And her husband's kind of a researchy guy.
Right. He was kind of the brains behind
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but see, if he would have been running the company, he'd have probably just given the technology to Microsoft
sure.
and got nothing for it.
Mm-hmm.
Or published four or five papers, and he would have been noted as Mr. VMware who got no money.
Right.
So she was able to commercialize this product. She was very effective at pulling the ideas out of the research lab and getting them into the marketplace. And she was quite proud of the fact that they assembled a team of very talented PhDs who would continue to innovate. Now, so she was a little upset in 2007.
Upset would be a better word.
That she only got 2.1%. And then she was really upset in July 8th of 2008, which was only the next year, she was unexpectedly fired.
Gee, who'd have thought that?
She was replaced by Paul Meritz, who was running EMC's cloud computing division. So she was just crowded out. I guess she had a bad attitude after that IPO.
No kidding.
And then on September 10th, 2008, Rosenblum, who was the company's chief scientist, resigned. So the founders, who actually started VMware, left, and EMC had it. But it's a great story of how a couple could take an idea that was in the university and build it up to a multi-billion dollar company. So now she's become an angel investor.
Mm-hmm.
She also likes to sail, so she has a trimaran. You know, instead of a catamaran has two holes,
a trimaran has
three holes. And she takes that out on San Francisco Bay. So I think she's living a good life, but she's still worried about missing the upside on VMware.
Now, it's still worried. I mean, several hundred million dollars is more than either of you or IRA.
I know. And so this is always the challenge when you have a startup. At what point do you sell?
Mm-hmm.
Do you hold out for the big bucks or do you sell sooner?
Mm-hmm.
And I think since the big bucks came so quickly, she probably could have sold a little later and made quite a bit more.
Oh.
And there you know, all you want to know about Diane Green, who was co-founder with her husband and served as president and CEO of VMware.
You better have been paying attention, because in just a minute, you'll have a chance to win free food from us when we play the pop quiz here on Tech Talk Radio. The number you'll need is 877-936-9333. We'll be back with the question and your calls here on Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, five of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Yes, you thought this was a radio show, but actually, it's a classroom of the airways.
You didn't give me a chance to be wrong.
I know. Mm-hmm. But you figured it out.
I have.
It only took you three years, and now you pretty much know it's classroom of the airways. Uh-huh. Of course, it's classroom of the airways. It's classroom of the streaming internet channel, and so we've got it everywhere. Earlier in the show, I was talking about Diane Green. She, of course, is co-founder of VMware with her husband Mendel Rosenblum. Earlier in her career, she was designing offshore oil platforms, and then she was told she couldn't visit one of the platforms as a woman, and she quit in disgust. What did she do after she quit in disgust?
Mm-hmm.
If you get the correct answer to that, you will get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room. And all you have to do is call us on our POTS line, which has a number that I don't know.
That's right. You do know, but you're just being kind and letting me put it out there. It's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of San Francisco but east of Rochester, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333.
And if you're calling from anywhere else in the world, you can call by Skype. Go to Tech Talk Radio 1, and that call will go directly through to the studio free of charge.
That's right. Okay.
You know, the Mars rover has really been performing quite well this week. I just love this. It's such a huge NASA success.
Mm-hmm.
The Mars Curiosity deployed its arm for the first time this week. That's very important because it's going to have to pick stuff up to get samples, and the arm's working perfectly. Then the ChemCam, which is basically it fired a laser for the first time using a beam, and then it shined instruments on the dust from the laser hit, and they tried to interrogate, as they say, a fist-sized rock, which they called Coronation. It's a rock about 3 inches in diameter. Now, Curiosity also successfully testivated the steering actuator so it could move its wheels. This is the first time that NASA moved the wheels on Mars. Then Curiosity completed its first drive. They drove 3 meters forward, performed 260-degree rotations to sort of, you know, point the imaging cameras in different directions, and then it drove backwards 3 meters in order to test the wheels in the opposite direction. Now, NASA is also turning on the sample analysis, which is an instrument which will pull in atmospheric gases from Mars, and they'll test what's in those gases to see if they can determine the composition of the atmosphere. Now, within days, Curiosity is going to start its journey to its chosen destination on Mars, Glennelg, which is around 400 meters away, and they hope to obtain their first drill rock samples at Mars at this location. This is great. Everything is working on this thing. I'd love to track the progress.
It is a very slow-moving device, is it not?
Yeah, it moves at 0.06 miles per hour.
Let me interject that we do not have a winner yet. And, Doc, why don't you ask the question one more time?
Okay, earlier in the show, I talked about Diane Green, co-founder of VMware. After she was unable to go onto the oil platform, she quit in disgust and went to Hawaii to do what?
Okay. If you have the answer to that question, you can call us. Make it easy. Anywhere in the Continental 48, you can call us on 877-936-9333. Once again, that's 877-936-9333. Doc, why don't you hit something else here while we're waiting.
Okay, the Space Elevator Conference.
Oh, I just love this.
Oh, yeah. The Space Elevator Conference is being held in Seattle this weekend. I always like to track the results of the Space Elevator. Now, this is an elevator that goes all the way to space. Now, you might say, how can that be?
How can that be, Doc?
What's holding it up?
What is holding it up?
Okay, let's suppose, we'll have an experiment. Suppose you would take a rope, and you tie a weight at the end of the rope, and then you start spinning around, and the rope is going out horizontally as you spin around, and it's being held out horizontally because of the centrifugal force exerted by that rock as you spin around. That's the principle of the space elevator, except in this case, the rope is attached to the equator, and it's a very, very long string that goes way out into space.
And there's
a weight at the end, and as the Earth spins around, that weight, which would be a satellite or some kind of object out there, would pull the ribbon very tight, and then you could then have an elevator that could go right up the ribbon. How does this sound, Jim?
This sounds like there's a whole lot that could go wrong.
There's a lot that could go wrong. First of all, you don't want an airplane to run into your ribbon.
That could be a problem.
That would be a problem. Now, here's the issue. They can't use just regular materials because they weigh too much, and the weight of the materials would be so heavy and produce so much strain that they would break. And so they actually don't have a physical material that's suitable for the ribbon.
So they would really just use ribbon, right? Well, that wouldn't be strong enough.
No, ribbon would not be strong
enough. Scotch tape?
And so they have theoretically shown that carbon nanotubes are strong enough.
Ah.
So this is a very dense structure of carbon nanotubes where we have a single atoms of carbon form a small tube. And it's very light because it's hollow on the inside, but extremely strong because it's such a densely packed collection of carbon atoms. And carbon nanotubes have the low density and the tensile strength to be successful. The problem is they can't make carbon nanotubes thousands of miles long.
No, I guess they can
make carbon nanotubes in the lab that are just very tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to scale the carbon nanotube tube technology. And so everybody is like waiting for carbon nanotubes to be a mature technology so they can get carbon nanotube ribbons.
And, of course, this might cost more than $5.
It's possible it could cost more than $5. So what's the purpose of the conference?
They
want to get all the technical people together to talk about the issues and what the barriers are. We all know what the barrier is. We don't have the carbon nanotubes yet. They also would like to have seminars to raise public awareness about the space elevator. And the reason they want public awareness raised is that they need money. And if the public doesn't say, "Hey, let's just spend $100 million on the space elevator," they're afraid that may not be spent. And then finally, they're hoping that somebody's going to show up with a carbon nanotube breakthrough.
Guess what?
It's not. I haven't heard it.
No, and I'm not going to ride it when they build it.
It'll be a while, and it goes up very slowly.
That kind of time.
When you go up, it might take several days to get up into outer space because you're going up very slowly.
Well,
and of course, how do you power the thing? And they frequently they're thinking of shining a laser on it and using the electrical power generated by the laser to actually propel it up the carbon ribbon.
Here's the thing. I don't think I want to be on any kind of elevator that's moving way too fast.
Yeah, and there are also issues that as it goes through the radiation belts, you know, it might create a problem. Now, what they're thinking is that they're projecting that looking at the rate of technology development, that carbon carbon nanotubes may be mature enough around 2041.
Okay, good.
So we got to wait a few years. But in 2041, Jim, you may be able to just take the ride of your life.
I doubt it.
Now, the reason they want to do it is that then space launching a satellite will be one-tenth the cost because they just send it up by elevator, mm-hmm. and they don't need a rocket.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. All you want to know about space elevators.
How about when it goes through the Earth's atmosphere? Would it then burn you to a crisp?
No, because it comes down very slowly.
Ah.
It's up very slow, down very – there's not the normal reentry stuff.
I'm sorry.
It's very, very slow.
This is just not for me.
I know. I can see that.
We do have a victim on the line here. Let's go to line number one. I'm sorry, this is line three. This is Kathy calling from Gainesville, Virginia. Good morning, Kathy. How are you?
Good morning.
And, Doc, go ahead and ask the question
again,
please.
Earlier in the show, we talked about Diane Greene, co-founder of VMware with her husband.
He almost forgot.
I almost forgot about Diane. I'm sorry. I've got this Venturi thing on. I got this.
Yeah, why don't you speed it up? Right, we're running out of time.
I got this wine deal going on the side here. What Diane was very frustrated when she could not go on the drilling rig, and so she quit in disgust and went to Hawaii. What did she do while she was in Hawaii?
She did windsurfing.
That is correct.
Diane, you're a winner. Tell her what she's won.
You win two tickets to Fine Dining, Escoff the A Dining Room, or the Karim Dining Room. Just stay on the line and give your name and address and email address to Andrew, and we'll get those tickets out to you next week.
Diane, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Stand by. Andrew will indeed be right with you. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2, 103.5 FM, HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it's time to bring out the laboratory experiments.
Yeah, this ought to be fun.
Yeah, we're going to aerate some red
You'll
wine
You'll need to
here.
Hold it up to your microphone so people can see it.
Yes, here, I'm going to hold it up to the mic. This is the Venturi, V-I-T-U-R-I, aerator, and what it has, the reason I like it, it uses a Venturi effect. The wine goes through this device beside two small holes, and it sucks in air using the Venturi effect. Mm-hmm. Whenever you pass over the surface of a hole, you create a vacuum, and you can pull, and it then creates this vacuum that then sucks in air, and it mixes with the wine, and it aerates the wine one glass at a time. I mean, I've been using this, we had friends in Colorado that showed us this.
Uh-huh.
And I ordered it. It came in this week. It's so much fun. So I've got this. Let me get this. I've got this Cabernet here, Jim.
Oh, it looks delicious.
Now, Jim, listen. Now, the thing is,
it's
the Cabernet.
It's only 10 o'clock.
I really like this Raymond Cabernet from Napa Valley. It's really excellent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
and so I'm going to take and pour. I hope David Byrd doesn't come in when he hears we got wine.
I doubt that's going to happen.
I don't want Dave. Okay, I'm going to pour it through, and you're going to hear the Venturi operating. Can you hear that?
I can hear that.
It's going in. There are two Venturis. It's operating. Oh, yeah. This is a huge glass.
It is. This is like the big gulp of wine.
This, yeah, this is the... Yeah, this, Whoa, wow, that's a big glass of
wine. I hope you got
wine.
A driver today, Doc, because
that's going to be
pretty amazing. Yeah, there's no batteries. It's just two holes in this thing.
It's just two holes, and it pulls through with the Venturi effect. It just sucks in the air, and you can hear it sucking in the air. That's what that noise is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was questioning whether this thing really made a sense. So right. I would take blind tests. Take two glasses, pour one through the Venturi aerator and one just into the wine glass, and I would let people test both glasses, and invariably, even people that don't drink that much wine would say the one that went through the aerator tasted better.
Interesting. So I guess after four or five tests, it really doesn't matter anymore, does it?
It doesn't matter. So you can aerate wine if you pour it into a carafe and let it sit for an hour and a half, but this way you can aerate it one glass at a time.
That's amazing.
In real time.
And do it a lot quicker.
So those of you that drink box wine and only take out one glass at a time, you can aerate your box wine one glass at a time.
Why are you looking at me?
I'm not looking at you at all, Jim. No, I think Andrew needs that right now.
Maybe Andrew.
Right
this second.
Yeah, maybe I should send in this Cabernet to Andrew. But he may not be.
Well, you've got a driver. Just drink it on the way.
I'll just drink it. I got it in a cup here.
Advice for
so you can go to Venturi.com, Venturi.com. I ordered the thing online. It was like $30 or something. It was a great deal. So there you go. Our laboratory experiment and I love this because when I serve wine now, I can talk about the Venturi effect. It's like
fantastic.
Physics and wine combined.
I'm sure your guests will just be mesmerized.
Yeah, they are.
Let's just keep it here because we're late on time.
Let's talk about social media and the political conventions. Okay, the Democrats and Republicans are using social media to open their conventions. The Republican call theirs a convention without walls.
Gosh.
While the Democrats say their gathering will be the most open and accessible in history. Democrats will not just show primetime speeches live on the internet, but they'll also stream caucus meetings and council discussions of the party's platform and ideals over the web. Republicans have hired full-time bloggers and full-time digital communication managers to do nothing but engage people online. The convention's Facebook and Twitter sites are already stoking interest in the event, with photos of the Republican stage under construction in Tampa and profiles of the Democratic volunteers and delegates. Users can interact by clicking links on these sites. They can urge friends to join the GOP to make contributions. The Twitter feeds are actually trying to get more and more supporters. Both had more than 10,000 followers on Friday. This is the Twitter feed for the conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, social media is on the rise in politics. The number of items posted on Twitter on Election Day 2008 is equal to about 6 minutes worth of postings today. I mean, that's a huge, huge increase.
Sure.
Now, the planning, the protesters are also getting organized over the internet, and they're getting people all organized to come in down there. So social media is allowing, now this is the most important thing that the campaigns like, they're allowing the campaigns to get out their message without being shifted or changed by the media. They can get out the message they want without being filtered, and they absolutely love it. The Pew Research Center found that Obama's campaign is a little bit more active than Mitt Romney's on the digital front, but they're both using it very actively. Hey, listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu and check us out on the web at stratford.edu.
This program will be rebroadcast later today at 4 o'clock. We'll see you next week here on Tech Talk.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
Any game heard here last night on Federal News Radio, the Nats lost to the Phillies 4-2. Today, they take the field and Gio Gonzalez goes for his league-leading 17th win against the Phillies. Game time here at 7:05. Pre-game starts at 6:30. The forecast is going to be a cloudy day in the nation's capital. Chance for showers later on. A high today in the low 80s. Right now outside our beautiful Palacio Studios in Northwest Washington, it is 74 degrees and it is now 10 a.m.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take